Well, hello everyone. Thank you very much for joining. Today we have Hriday Chaitanya with us, a very adventurous soul, also very willing to come here and share what he has to offer today on anthropomorphism and theomorphism, understanding what it means to be made in his image. So I'll tell you a little bit about Hriday Chaitanya. This is a short bio. Hriday Chaitanya was born, he grew up in France in a Catholic family. His father was a philosophy professor and his mother was a teacher. He left school at the age of 15 to play music in the streets, to travel, and to learn farming and dedicate himself to his spiritual quest and the study of different languages. At 23, he made a vow to walk all the way to Vrindavan from France, following an ancient pilgrimage tradition. He walked over 16 months, reaching the south of Iran before being forced to leave after spending 3 months crossing the Persian desert. The authorities kicked him out, so he flew directly straight to Vrindavan, unable to complete his vow. Hriday arrived there feeling like a failure rather than a victor. But in hindsight, he feels that the incomplete vow was the greatest gift he ever received. And at that time, his wife, who he has been with since they were 14 years old, was traveling with him. There he met his spiritual master in Govardhan and took initiation a year later. Since then, Hriday and his wife have been living in India with their two sons. Both of them were born in Bengal. So in Bengal, he farms, works as a professional translator, and edits books for his Guruji based on his lectures. So thank you very much for joining us, Hriday Chaitanya. And
Thank you.
yes, really looking forward to hear what you have to share today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's an honor, really. Should I start?
Yes, please.
All right. Om Agyanatimirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पवनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. सो फर्स्ट ऑफ ऑल थैंक यू भक्तिरस फॉर योर इंट्रोडक्शन एंड थैंक यू फॉर द इनविटेशन एज वेल. आई'd लाइक टू एक्सप्रेस माय प्रणाम्स, माय ग्रेटिट्यूड एंड माय डीप रिस्पेक्ट एंड फ्रेंडशिप फॉर पद्मनाभ स्वामी जी एज वेल फॉर इन्वाइटिंग मी टुडे. थैंक यू हूएवर इज हियर राइट नाउ फॉर बीइंग हियर. I sincerely hope I won't waste your precious time. The truth is, I feel highly unqualified to be the one talking. It's the first time for me. It's the first time exercise for me. I'm going to do my best to at least not kill you with boredom. I also want to specify something: is that anything I say that may go against the Gaudiya Vedanta is, in any case, not an attempt for myself to argue or contradict anything. It's the pure consequence of my ignorance in the matter. So, to my elders present here today, please forgive me and correct me if you feel I have promoted some kind of dangerous or subversive views in any regard. And in this regard, I want to quickly clarify one particular use I will make of the word Vaikuntha throughout this discussion. So, I will not refer to Vaikuntha as a higher world or one higher reality, or the spiritual world as we usually tend to represent it in our particular tradition. I will refer to it as the reality. So everyone has obsessions, right? And my obsession is semantic and etymology. I'm a big fan of languages. So I will apply my etymological bias to the word Vaikuntha, and I will use it as the reality, free from kunta, as in free from the contraction, the shrinking of consciousness once it has identified with a particular form. So Vaikuntha will designate the reality, and I will make a distinction between the cosmos, So the manifested world in which we live and the reality, Vaikuntha. And interestingly, I will try to show that Srila Swami Prabhupada himself made this use of the word reality. Actually, this etymological perspective, I will see things through this lens in many ways throughout the discussion, because I think words contain so much and we can't really approach such a topic without doing our minimum semantic homework. And the last thing I want to clarify before I start is an acronym that I will use sometimes. This acronym is PIE. I'm not going to go into technical details, don't worry, but it just means Proto-Indo-European. And since I can't pronounce this word clearly and it's too long, I'll just use the acronym PIE. And it's considered as the proto-language of all Indo-European languages, including Sanskrit and including English, French, Spanish, so many languages. So PIE, when I refer to this, the PIE root of a word, it means the Proto-Indo-European root of a word. So that's just to quickly clarify the use of the term Vaikuntha and the use of this acronym. So the title of today's discussion is Anthropomorphism vs. Theomorphism, Understanding What It Means to Be Made in His Image. So as we acknowledge being persons in this Sangha, I'd like to give some quick background to the choice of the topic. So my Gurudev always told me that someone who talks about something that they haven't realized fully may do more harm than good. When I heard that the first time, I seriously considered staying mute forever. But I'm not necessarily applying this instruction in a literal sense, and I guess we should get the essence of it. But in any case, this particular topic today is very dear to me for one main reason, and this reason is sort of an epiphany I had in the desert when I was, as Bhaktirasa said, I was alone there for several months trying to cross the big Iranian desert on foot to reach Pakistan and then India. So during this long walking in the desert, and as crazy as it sounds, there's a bush, a small bush, started talking to me. I promise I wasn't on any drugs or anything, but it literally started talking to me. And the bush was kind of pink color, and it filtrated the light of the sunrise every morning in a very peculiar and beautiful way. This bush was growing everywhere. It was the only survivor of numerous sandstorms, very violent sandstorms. So I could see it every morning when I would pack my tarp and my camp, I would see the same bush. And the light through this bush started sending information to me. It was very weird. And slowly in my dreams, this bush literally, and I mean it literally, turned my world upside down. And this expression, upside down, is very significant for today's topic. So for 2 months, I was in a different state of consciousness where everything was understood from up to down in a descending flow. You know, in some ways, it resembles some psychedelic trips. For those who know about it, there's kind of a peculiar porosity between metaphysical and physical categories, in that we start hearing colors and seeing concepts that take shape, and sounds start taking shape as well. Well, in the desert, I realized that without any drugs of any kind, just being lonely, silent, and singing mantras for extended periods of time in the desert could trigger much more than LSD or anything. Because the significance of shapes, colors, and the very organization of matter around me started showing brand new implications. They appear to me as clues and hints of the real thing. And I don't mean this in a philosophical way, I mean very physically. And later on, I named this experience the sacred analogy. And this is where we will dive into this today, the sacred analogy. So that was a very quick summary of my so-called desert epiphany. And the second episode of my life, which brought me to love this topic so much, is the first time I met my Guruji, something like 10 years ago. I ended up in one of his lecture in a city of France. My Guruji is from South India, but he travels a lot. At one point, Guruji was talking about the Gaudiya conception of the spiritual world. And he would use great details like trees, fruits, rivers, people. So I raised my hand, and as I love to do, I asked quite of a provocative question. I was young and dumb, so that's what I did. And in substance, I accused him of projecting human conceptions onto the absolute reality. I accused him of like creating a nice little pink world for us humans as a therapy, a way for us to imagine a better world than the dark hole in which we're living right now. And Guruji's answer struck me. He said, in substance, he said, the only reason why you think this way is because you approach reality from down to up. You think anything so-called higher, which resembles what you know through your senses, has to be the resembling. And you and your world have to be the resembled. But if you reverse your approach, you will start considering that you are the resembling, and the resembled is what people generally call God. So anyway, from these two personal experiences, this topic got some particular, like special importance in my journey. So I will quickly outline the structure of the discussion today. First, I will explain the title, and then we will go through two main objectives, the two main objective like goals of this discussion, which are, the first one is change our angle of vision. It's taken from Sridhar Maharaj, who would always say this, change your angle of vision. And the second object, like the second goal of the discussion, is how can we always think about Krishna and never forget about him, which is smartavya hastatatam Vishnu. Like, it's considered true samadhi for us. So let's start. We'll explain the title that has these scary words, right? So let us explain the title. Since like whenever a question is asked, I think the terms of the question have to be defined so we can keep track of our intention throughout the process. So the first word is anthropomorphism. This word is composed of three parts. The first one is anthropo. It comes from the Greek anthropo, itself coming from classical Greek, which sometimes we call Attic Greek, aner, which means someone who is not a woman, a god, or a boy. You have the alpha privative, a, and then ner, which is the Indo-European root for man, vigorous, vital, and strong. So the meaning has evolved through over time to designate what pertains to the humankind in general. And it's, by the way, interesting to note that our term for human beings is essentially masculine and even derives from a Indo-European root meaning the strong and vigorous male. It's a strong bias that's certainly important to consider, but we're not going to dive into this today. As for morphe, anthropomorphe, the second part of this word, it means the shape or the form in Greek. And then you have the final ism at the end of the word, which usually denotes a systematic approach, like an ideology or something along those lines. So we get anthropomorphism, namely the approach that consists of attributing human characteristics to so-called non-human entities, and in our context, the concept of God. That's the first word. The second word of the title is theomorphism. And in this particular context, this word does not refer to any ancient Christian heresy or anything like this, but it's rather an upside down version of anthropomorphism, since theos means God in Greek. So this word refers to, like, the word theomorphism refers to the attribution of divine characteristics to human beings. And for the record, I even thought I'd invented the word a few years ago when I was in the desert without internet. And for several months, I thought I'd come up with the word myself until I got back online and realized that it wasn't the case at all. It's been used for centuries. And the third part of our title is made in his image. So this is a verse from the Bible, Genesis, where Yahovah, or the Elohims, depending on the understandings, say, let us do humans in our image. So we're going to take a quick look at the use of the word image, because it's the key to our entire discussion today. So Genesis was originally written in Hebrew, at least in part, And then it was transcribed into Greek, Latin, and all the European languages. So we have three words to explore: the Hebrew word, the Greek word, and then the European word, English, French, whatever. In my opinion, it's not only three words, but it's really three worlds, and we'll see how. So the Hebrew word for image is shelem, which is related to the root tel in Hebrew, which means the shadow. So the Bible describes us as shadowy reflections of the Elohim, of God. And the word tzel in Hebrew is also used for phantom, illusion, and even idols, like a parody of something real. So we can see that there's a positive aspect to this verse, in that it's rather a good news if we are God-like, but also a negative potential. We can be idols somehow. So idols are worshipped, right? So who is worshipping us? Well, actually, we have the potential to be our own worshippers and suffer from this. So we're going to try to dive into this. So from the Hebrew word tselem, we have to remember the concept of shadowy reflections, idols, and illusion. Now we have the Greek translation of tselem, which is ikon, for image. And ikon has many meanings in Greek. It means likeness, portrait, image in a mirror, or phantom image, and even semblance. So I'm not asking you to remember all these words, of course. It's just to kind of like settle an atmosphere and give some context. So let us remember the idea of likeness and mirror from this Greek word. Now, and although I generally am quite critical of the biblical translations into modern Latin languages, the usual English translation of tselem and or ikon is image. And it's very interesting as well, actually, like fortunately. These words come from the PIE, Proto-Indo-European root em, and has this root in common with imagination, emulation. So it means a copy, an imitation, or even better, an emulation of something. So from the third word that is used for image, so namely image in European Latin translation of the word tselem, we should remember the notions of emulation and copy. And we'll try to dive into this step by step and, of course, create some connection with Krishna. So I just want to remind quickly that the discussion has two main objectives. The first one will sound a bit theoretical, and hopefully it's not meant to stay theoretical. And the second one will be a bit more relatable and practical. So the first one is change our angle of vision, and the second one is always think of Krishna and never forget him. So let's start with change our angle of vision. So I'd like to kick off this first part of our discussion by sharing a few interesting insights about the macro and the micro structure of our reality. We won't have time to dig into these specifics today, but it's more a way to provide some context, also settle an atmosphere, and hopefully open further horizon after this discussion for those who want to dive deeper into it. I'll do it in the form of questions. So did you know that if you look at the human body with a high-powered microscope, you will see galaxies, starry skies, and Milky Ways? Do you know that humans and our galaxy are made up of 97% of the same atoms? Do you know that if we map our human nervous system, it looks exactly like an upside-down tree? This upside-down tree appearance has even been used as an educational metaphor in scientific articles and universities. So upside-down tree image is something that reminds us of our Vedic Shastra, right? Do you know that the structure of neurons in the human brain bears a striking resemblance to the large-scale distribution of galaxies in the universe? They both have complex web-like networks that seem to mirror each other visually, with like a dense core and branching filaments. Like, do you know that blood vessels and cosmic filaments look exactly the same? Have you ever seen the microscope photograph of a human eye and compared it to a black hole? There's so many examples like this. The electrons orbiting a central nucleus on the atomic level looks exactly like planets orbiting central stars. And the last one is, do you know that the universe emits pulsars with a rhythmic pattern, just like the pulsations of our heart? So the background to all this discussion is, how literal is, for example, the Srimad Bhagavatam when it says that our 14 worlds correspond to different body parts of Vishnu? And why do we humans have exactly 14 chakras, 14 different points in our body from up to down as well? So this could be discussed for years. I'm just skimming the subject to make an introductory point. To which extent are we made in his image, and how much is this statement literal? So let's try to discuss this. I take literally the statement of Sridhar Maharaj when he says, change your angle of vision. And a good friend of mine just today reminded me that also Srila Swami Prabhupada said this many times, change your angle of vision. So if I take it literally, because I like to take things literally first and then dive into it, an angle of vision can be horizontal, lateral, vertical, 1D, 2D, 3D, low angle, overhead. And if we refer to a very famous parable from the Vedanta, we humans, for example, might easily mistake a rope for a snake. So in the context of changing our angle of vision, we could argue that this mistake is mostly due to a horizontal angle of vision. From a vertical angle, the rope will look like a rope. So the whole idea of the sacred analogy is to approach the cosmos in a vertical way. There are two movements on a vertical axis. From down to up, it's like devotional. So we from down are expressing our awe and our love to the highest. And we could say from up to down, it's initiatic. It's the only angle from which we can apprehend the cosmos, ourselves, and the entire reality. And by the way, it's interesting to note that the word parampara means that which descends from the top to the bottom. So ideally, our angle of vision should be from up to down if we want to understand things in their entire implications and scope. So why are bodies, spirits, and matter organized this way? The epiphany I got in the desert was that the way particles agglomerate and shape the forms of this world is as if someone said, draw me this sound. The forms of this world are physical representation of vibrations. Consciousness is a vibration, right? And it is what organizes matter. So physical shapes are the three-dimensional transpositions of this consciousness. So the forms around me suddenly took a very, very different meaning, and the very stake of my existence was transformed, and I mean it. Because if there are hints, it means there is a referent, that to which the hint is pointing to, right? Or the clue is hinting. And all the hints seem to point towards one reality that is the most accomplished, complex, and evolved form of consciousness is personal. So this referent started appearing to me more clearly, and I had these words echoing in my heart constantly, day and night. And these words were, Govinda is the original person. And day after day, this term of sacred analogy appeared to be the best way to describe what I had experienced during those months in the desert. So that's why I call the angle of vision I want to attain the sacred analogy. And I want to make it clear that it's really not a poetic view. And paradoxically, the name itself is not an analogy. Let me explain that. Analogy in this context refers to the very organization of our world. It is an analogical cosmos. So the sacred analogy as an approach is an epistemological shift leading to Sambandha Gyan. And then my own concocted word, maybe, but I don't know if it exists, but it would be Sambandha Vigyan, which means the experience of interconnections and relations between ontological categories. So let's do a very quick semantic homework about the word analogy because it's fascinating. The term analogy is a mix of the PIE root leg, which gave logos in Greek, by the way, and the suffix an, which refers to being on top of. So leg means to gather meanings, to gather significance. In that sense, the sacred analogy approach is an effort to extract significance. It's about considering things not just as things, but as meanings in themselves. So we distinguish between this thing means that blah, 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 and this thing is a meaning in itself. And as we maintain this approach of the cosmos, we gather more meanings, we gather more experiences. And this experience of everything as meanings or hints, as I like to call them, is sacred, deeply sacred, in that it is superior to the path that led to it. So hence the term of sacred analogy. You know, the analogical approach that is very present in our Shastra, very much. This analogical approach of the cosmos is not very postmodern friendly, I would say. Because like modern science tends to say that the underlying principle organizing life and even the architecture of the cosmos is the need to survive, to perpetuate our existence. For them, like according to modern science, postmodern science at least, even the universe is shaped in such a way because it strives to perpetuate itself. But we as bhaktas can wonder, what is downstream of this survival instinct? What are we trying to perpetuate? It seems that any survival in dynamic tends towards something other than itself. So the sacred analogy conclusion is that the cosmos is not trying to survive. It's actually narrating an event. And I will refer to this continuously throughout the discussion. Our world is narrating an event. The very architecture of our beings and of the cosmos is the expansion of a perpetual happening. So I picked a few ways to describe some aspects of this analogical cosmos of ours. So imagine the first one would be, imagine there is a primordial sound, and we, as well as the entire material manifestation, are the echo of this sound. The second example would be, just like words are made of prefix, suffix, roots, which evolve through time. Like every word has a root, and this root is usually connected to an event, a sensation felt by someone one day. There is an event beyond language, and a word appeared in order to convey this experience through sound and vibration, language. In that sense, there is a primordial emotion, and the world, or at least a primordial experience, and the world is the physical representation of this emotion. We are a physical projection of a happening. If someone would say, draw me this energy, we would be the drawing, and Vaikuntha would be the energy. In no way it means that the ultimate reality has no forms. It simply means that our forms are meanings. We are not the meant, we are the meanings. We're not the meant, we are the meanings. And the third example that we could use to try to explain that is, let's say something happened very long ago, and then stories, legends, tales appear and try to narrate this event through different bias and ecosystems of those. So in this case, Vaikuntha is the event, and the world is the tale. In the tale, the event has left some hints, some clues. And we can gather as much clues as possible about the event from that tale. And gather is connected to analogy, as I explained before. Technically, the only mistake we can do is to confuse the tale for the event. Apart from that, the tale, so this tale around us, is sacred, since it is the physical expansion of this Vaikuntha through a particular bias. This bias, sometimes we call it Mahamaya. It's a bias. It's like a map. The map is never the goal, but one who wants to go somewhere doesn't spit on his map and burn it, arguing that, you know, this is just a map, it's not the actual thing. Well, sure, but the map can be really helpful if we want to get to the actual place. So we should have deep respect for the map. So to summarize, the world, ontological nature, according to the sacred analogy, is that of a narrative. And Vaikuntha, or the reality, is the event to which this narrative refers. Once again, I just want to make it clear, the sacred analogy is not meant to be a speculative exercise, but a physical experience. We are not comparing the world with a narrative. When we say this, we claim that the world is a narrative. It is an enigma. And the terms of the enigma are all around us and inside us as well. Like, we are living enigmas. A very structure is meant to inform us about something. It's like someone left a message in the way the world is designed. And mystical practices are an attempt to hear this message, not for the sake of hearing it, but because we want ultimately to meet the object of this message. That is, he who is meant by those meanings, right? And as human individuals, we're kind of the final clue. The revelation that we embody is that the original event is an individual, it's a person. That is what we mean by our very makeup. So the idea is to have enough ability of abstraction to truly exist and decode our own nature to see the imprint of the divine in it. You know, we may feel tempted to say that the event, so Krishna, in our case, we can call it Krishna, is so we may feel tempted to say that Krishna is also an individual. But the sacred shift that I'm referring to here is to reverse this reflex that we have. We should always say we are also individuals, and we should never use the other way around, according to the sacred analogy approach. I respectfully disagree with using the expression human-like Leela of Krishna, for instance. As a wannabe sacred analogist, I will always make sure to say our godlike activities. So Nara Leela to me is a particular Leela of which we as humans are the hints. The whole point is to always think in this way. If we think in this way, we will start seeing in this way, and by seeing in this way, our experience of the world, of others, and of ourselves may totally change for the better. And I think I know it can definitely serve our bhakti journey. So for now, we have briefly, I mean, when I say I know it can serve a bhakti journey, I mean for those who have this particular taste. Okay, I'm not giving any absolute power to the sacred analogical approach. I'm just saying for those who have this inclination, I think the sacred analogy can be really conducive for bhakti. That's what I meant. So for now, we have briefly described the ultimate reality as the only event, and the cosmos as we know it as a web of clues, hints, and tales, conveying reflections, messages, and mirrored images of the reality. So this means that if something moves in the ultimate reality, our world will narrate it through different bias. So some of you may wonder, is this a pure speculation of mine, or can we back this up with some Shastric authority, you know? So I don't have, I mean, I have, but it's kind of like there's so many quotes that I could use right now. So I chose to use mainly Srila Swami Prabhupada quotes in this regard. I'm not going to give you all the context, place, date, and everything for these quotes, but for those who are interested, I can, of course, send them to you afterwards. So Prabhupada said, Maya is working just like shadow. Just like here is shadow of my hand. If I shake my hand, the shadow also shakes. The Maya is acting like that. So Maya is acting under the direction of Krishna. Just like the shadow is moving under the movement of the original. So please note the use of the word original and shadow, because original entails a copy, and the concept of copy was clearly contained in the word image, and tel in Hebrew means shadow, literally. The second quote is, just like shadow moves by the movement of the reality, similarly, this material nature is working under the direction of the Supreme. So here we can see that Srila Swami Prabhupada himself distinguishes reality from material nature. It means that there is reality and then something which synchronizes with it in some way, but it has no autonomy whatsoever. The third quote is, she is working just like a shadow. The original body and the shadow body, they are two different. But the shadow body moves if the original moves. So again, we can notice the use of the word original, which entails a copy. And the last quote that I want to use from Srila Prabhupada is, she is working simply just like a shadow. As the shadow moves, when the original substance moves, similarly, she is only working under the direction of Krishna. That's all. She is the external potency. So again, there is a clear distinction between substance, reality, and the shadow world. So imagine a hand is moving and its shadow is synchronized with this movement. But we know that the shadow will be distorted by the surface on which it is reflected, right? There's so many factors and bias that will shape this shadow. So if one would attempt to read this shadow and try to deduct the shape of the original object looking at the shadow, one would probably feel like trying to solve a riddle or an enigma. Well, this is exactly how we're trying to describe the world through the approach of sacred analogy. We are significant emulations in that our very makeup is emulating a reality and signify as in to be a sign of. The written letter, for example, A, is a signification of a particular vibration, right? Well, our bodies, forms, colors, everything are significations of certain vibrations. So yes, we can say that we are made in his image, but how are we made in his image? Tel, the word image. Well, in that the material world, including us, is a shadow, as we described, and sort of a biased copy image of Vaikuntha, of reality. So from now on, we can, like, there is one rather negative connotation to being copies of Krishna. It means we operate as in sort of a parody or a mockery, right? I don't know if I pronounced this properly, but... And, well, you know, we all know the narrative of Lucifer coming down from heaven, wanting to carry the light by himself within the darkness, right? The famous non serviam, which means I won't serve. This is how the whole thing started for Christians. So Lucifer is the archetype describing the initiative we took as souls in order to enter the world and play within it. If we refer to this archetype of Lucifer, and if we are copies of Krishna in his image, it seems that we are rather like parodic copies or like mock copies, right? And it doesn't sound so respectable and exciting. However, I think there are two ways, probably much, much more, but at least two ways to bring some positivity in there. First of all, we could say a shadow is very faithful. It always follow the original everywhere, right? It has the power to always follow the original. That's a great prospect for us if the original is Krishna. It means, in one sense, we don't have the choice. We're always following Krishna as his shadow, right? Secondly, the word image is also closely connected to the word, emulation through their common PIE root, as we said before, right? So emulation means to try to excel in qualities or actions that one admires in another. It is like a virtuous circle. So at first glance, being made in his image doesn't sound so positive, but the idea of emulation opens a lot of possibilities because it seems like we can choose between different way of being those images. We can copy or mimic. We can narrate, as I explained before. We can shadow or we can emulate. And we can probably do much more, but let's focus on those. And as we said earlier, the word image is also closely connected to imagination. It's actually the same root. So what if we were made in his imagination? You know, after all, the word shadow is also used for shadow world in the Abrahamic traditions, as in like the world of dreams, right? And isn't it said in the Sanatana Shastra that our multiverse as a whole is Lord Vishnu's dream? Everything seems to point in one direction. And to summarize this direction, our cosmos, including our bodies, subtle and material, is a narrative, a hint, an enigma, a copy, potentially a parody or a mockery through our actions, a shadow, an emulation. I don't know how to pronounce that, and a dream. So hopefully each of us can choose to see this world as one of those and truly change their angle of vision. As wannabe bhaktas, I think the most, and this is really my personal opinion, but at least in my case, I would say the most fruitful angle of vision would be that of an emulation, like a divine dream and a narrative. I think those conception really carry bhakti, like bhakti is inherent to those conceptions. And it is really important to notice that all these terms that I just listed can only be used respectively with an event for a narrative, a reference, an answer or a revelation, an original, an ideal or a model, and a dreamer. So, according to our particular personal perspective, we will therefore see reality as, so reality as like Vaikuntha, as the hinted, I don't know how to say, like the that which is hinted, the referent, the answer, the original, the model, and the dreamer. So I invite you, if you accept to do so, for a very quick 30 seconds meditation. And during this meditation, the only thing I would like us to keep in mind is that Krishna, as we conceive it, as the all-attractive, ultimately and firstly, is a person in all that it can be. It's never just a concept. And keeping this in mind, I invite you to close your eyes and feel which of these names kind of rings a bell within your heart when you think of Krishna. Maybe it won't ring any bell, and this is totally fine. But so, which of these names kind of rings a bell within your heart when you think of Krishna as, I repeat, the referent? The event, the answer, the resolution, the revelation, the original person. The ideal, and the dreamer. To some of us, this conception might sound a bit gyanic, like gnostic for like gyanic, right? I'm sorry if it disturbs anyone. I think there is a huge potential of reconciliation between jnana and bhakti if it's done properly. I may be trying to justify my own bias towards jnana, and but I still sincerely dislike to oppose those two. And if our ways of acquiring knowledge, like our epistemology, is healthy and transparent, I consider that we can only conclude that reality is a person. So if jnana is here to inform bhakti originally, and since bhakti is infinite, jnana should probably be infinite as well. You know, in this regard, we've met a specific branch of Muslim Sufism with Padmanabha Swamiji in France a few weeks ago. And although extremely complex and cerebral, I felt like their gyan enhanced my feeling of devotion towards a personal absolute. It really helped me not to reject jnana in the name of bhakti, but more like to engage jnana into the bhakti journey. And I really, to some extent, I realized that if the ways we acquire knowledge are based on the sacred analogy, the hints and the clues contained all around us and inside us will spontaneously and naturally lead to bhakti. And this is where we get to the second goal of this discussion, which is how can we always think of Krishna and never forget him? And how can the sacred analogy approach can help us in this regard? I don't know about you, but as far as I'm concerned, my bhakti journey really works in waves, or maybe I should call them like hurricanes, right? But in any case, I regularly get purified by a phase, like a period that I like to call the wave of awkwardness and irrelevance. That's the way I call it for myself. That's the best way for me to describe it. And when this wave catches me, one of its main effects on me is that anything related to Krishna as a blue boy playing with cows in a yellow dhoti appears as dramatically irrelevant and awkward to me. It's like I can't relate to this image anymore. And further than this, I almost become allergic to any harikatha that are too literal or graphic about Krishna as a person, like dressed like an Indian, eating ladhus, stealing butter, or whatever. So over time, I've learned how to get through these waves as peacefully as possible, but still it kind of shakes me every time. And the sacred analogy, kind of rooted in my desert epiphany, is the best thing that ever happened to me when it comes to addressing those waves of awkwardness and irrelevance, as I call them. So first of all, my opinion is that there is no harm to be unable to perceive Krishna as a blue boy. Actually, I think there is no harm being unable to anything, since being unable is being unable. It's not choosing to do or not do something, right? So I think these phases, this waves of, like these waves I was describing, are more of a call for something else, like a deeper perspective on who is Krishna. And if we learn how to go through them peacefully, we will actually fall in love with the blue boy in due time. And I even think that the blue boy will have a new depth, like a new layer of dizziness, as I like to say. So it's not about rejecting the blue boy at all. It's actually exactly the opposite. It's about accepting who we are right now and accepting to approach this infinite absolute blue boy through the ways that are appropriate for our present particular situation. We call it adhikar in Sanskrit. So what if we want to apply this principle of always think of Krishna, never forget him, but we are in the middle of a wave of irrelevance and awkwardness? And how can the sacred analogical approach can help us, right? Well, if we act as sacred analogists, there will be millions of backups around us, reminding us of him, of them, of Krishna, without the need for the blue boy image, which during those waves is temporarily irrelevant at this stage of our life. And instead of experiencing this phase as a dark night, we will see it as a new, exciting kind of hide and seek session offered by the infinite. You know, when Krishna said in the Bhagavad Gita, Antakale chamameva smaran mukdva kalevaram, yaha prayati samad bhavam, yati nasti atra samshaya, which means whoever leaves their body remembering me will attain my nature, will attain my reality. And Krishna says there is no doubt of this. Well, personally, I think for this to happen, and if Krishna is Karuna Sindhu, which means an ocean of mercy, then he must have kind of encoded in our world some means and clues to remember him. So, of course, in our tradition, we say we have Shastra, Parampara, Guru Vargas that will help us doing this smaranam process, like remembering Krishna. But we shouldn't forget, I think, that technically every living being, every aspect of everything in the universe could be our guru if only we had the ears to hear and the eyes to see. Guru is taking our hand to guide us towards Krishna, to bring us to Krishna. So if everything has the potential to be guru for us, it means everything properly seen and perceived are like a finger pointing towards Krishna. The only thing we lack is vision. Like the cosmos as an enigma, as we said in the first part of our discussion, is indeed comparable to a great hide-and-seek adventure. And the hide-and-seek game is the most erotic thing you can find in this universe. And when I use the word erotic, I use this word in its original meaning. Remember, I like the etymological lens. And this means to arouse desire. So not specifically sexual. Erotic here means the beloved hiding from the other beloved just to kind of stretch the time and delay union. And if we are familiar with the Gaudiya ecosystem, we're very familiar with this vocabulary, like separation and union. And we should remember that this vocabulary has always been used in erotic literature since the dawn of time, basically. So in a sacred and a logical perspective, it means that what we call erotic here on earth is a clue, a hint, a shadow, a dream, a model, and an inspiration from the reality. So which particular aspect of reality it is reflecting, I think we really don't have time to dive into this today. But the point is, the wave of awkwardness that I was talking about just before, it becomes an erotic proposal from the divine, namely like a play of loving signs that arouse our mystical desire. And I truly think it sounds much more positive and constructive than a dark night of the soul, you know? So there is a really a deep potential for positivity within these waves of spiritual awkwardness where we can't relate to anything we hear. If we see it as a erotic in the original meaning of the word, hide and seek, you know, it's... So as you may have noticed throughout this discussion, I'm clearly partial to theomorphism and not to anthropomorphism. Because theomorphism is what allows us to read our cosmos like a shastra. Like every single aspect of our reality becomes guru and shastra, providing we have the right angle of vision. Of course, it doesn't mean, what we usually call as guru and shastra remains the primary medium for us to acquire bhakti and knowledge, right? But I guess you see the point. Like, as in, ideally, if every single sensorial experience reminds me of Krishna, I will achieve the constant absorption in Krishna, and my senses won't be obstacles anymore. They will become like mediums for me to feel and see Krishna literally everywhere. So instead of seeing this world as a perverted reflection, as we often hear in India, for example, the sacred analogy offers to see this world as a web of hints. And from then on, we can appreciate hints for being hints, like not more, not less. Like we deeply respect every beings because they are clues in our journey, literally like signs on the road left here by reality to guide us step by step. And logically, we deeply respect our own selves as well because we know that we are clues for others and for ourselves as well. We are hints of the infinite. And as such, we and every living beings is deeply respectable. Even we could say worshipable in one sense. And we totally acknowledge this in the Sanatan Dharma traditions. We can give our pranams to trees, rivers, there's no problem. We don't have this concept of idolatry with like the world as an expansion of the infinite. So you remember we said that being made in his image, we can choose to copy or mimic, to narrate, to shadow, or to emulate. Well, we could, like, if we act as copies or mimics of the absolute, we will soon realize that we do not have the powers that the original has. So we expose ourselves to a lot of frustrations in that our quest for control and power will mostly bring exponential pains. You remember that the word tel in Hebrew also referred to idols. So we have the potential to be idols. And since idols have to be worshipped to be idols, we can choose to worship ourselves. We can give many examples of this. What I would call this like a spiritual aberration. We could give examples through social medias, certain new age movements, or even some people in our own tradition who have been called gurus, but were, actually worshiping themselves, right? So that's the negative potential of being what I just said before, like copies or emulation, specifically copies or mimics in this case. On the other hand, if we choose to emulate or narrate, we become the living witnesses of the absolute. Like the event that we narrate by our own existence is an event of love through union and separation. And naturally, we will want to serve the happening of this absolute event. And it is called Lila. We could even call it Lila Seva, I guess. I have no idea if this is heretic to say that, but in this particular context, I guess we call it Lila Seva. Our own existence, properly directed, is Lila Seva. We are all familiar with the saying, whatever happens to us is God's mercy. It's present throughout religious traditions, and we all know how challenging it can be to walk the talk, right, when we say this. But what if, in addition to this inner disposition of surrender, we would see the world as a map, like an enigma, unveiling bit by bit the divine nature of the entire reality? Like, what if every time we see a tree, an ocean, a cloud, or a bird, we wonder, what is this shape, this energy pointing to? Like, what aspect of the divine is being narrated through this particular shape, sound, or color? And furthermore, what if every time we see someone talking to us, we realize that the infinite is talking to us? And more than talking, the infinite is telling something about the infinite through this person. In this like mystical journey through the sacred analogy, we can meet different levels of hints left by the divine within our world, its shapes, its biology, its sounds, its colors, emotions, everything. From hints, we can start hearing what the divine is speaking. And from the speaking level, we can go on a deeper level and hear what the divine is talking, since there is a major qualitative gap between those two, right? And then from hearing, like Shravanam, we can start feeling rasa. And from feeling, we can start reciprocating. And this is how the magic of the sacred analogy operates. From exciting hints, like very gyanic, exciting hints, we can go all the way to a blissful, intimate, and eternal relationship with the all-attractive Krishna. as people trying to become Vaishnavas or Rasikajanas, as Śrīla Bhaktivinoda Thakura would say, so those who taste the nectar, the essence of everything. We don't waste time with the bark. We're trying to go directly to the sap, right? I think we should aim for, I mean, I think what we should aim for is above the idea of living. We want to exist more than just live. We want to have enough abstraction ability to truly exist. What Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has shown us is that when the truth enters our life, we go through a mystical ecstasy, which is like the most desirable thing ever for a jiva, right? So to conclude this discussion, I would like to create a connection between ecstasy and existence. Ecstasy means out of our current standing. So ex is, which is out of, and sta in Sanskrit means to stand in a position. It's one of the meaning of sta, right? You find it in Rajasthan, which later on referred to a place, like something that stands, right? And interestingly, the word existence is built with the exact same prefix and suffix. The suffix sta simply involved through like a linguistic phenomenon. Anyway, it's just those two words, ecstasy and existence, are the same basically. So if our goal is to exist, not just to live or survive, then we need ecstasy. There is no existence without ecstasy. Existence without ecstasy should be called surviving. And the ecstasy is on both sides, that of the referent, Krishna, and that of the hint, like the cosmos and the jivas. You know the famous Ekohum Bahushyam in the Rig Veda, which means, and the one became multiple, or and the one whole manifested otherness, literally refers to Krishna's ecstasy. It's the absolute who manifests something out of an absolute position. So it is literally what ecstasy mean. It's God's love pouring forth and manifesting its necessary prerequisite, namely otherness, namely us. So our very existence comes from divine ecstasy and heads towards ecstasy. And I guess we want to embrace this kind of sacred loop, you know? So applying sacred analogy, if we want to exist, we have to take some distance with our own being. That is what we call the abstraction ability. It's one of the prerequisites for Sambandha Gyan. It means to understand who we are, but not only, it means who we are in relation to whom, right? Then we need to recognize the hint of alterity or otherness in the very structure of our being. Then we need to track this otherness in everything, the hints, like the whole of our cosmos. Then we need to constantly, sincerely desire this otherness more than anything. And then we need to embrace this otherness through bhakti. Ultimately, the otherness that we are tracking through the hide-and-seek game of life will appear in its full-fledged aspect and become the other, and this is Krishna. Of course, from our perspective, he is the other, but you know, for love to happen, there has to be one and another. And if we see things from up to down, as we said in the beginning, one is Krishna and another is us. That is a prerequisite for love. So in that way, we will go from surviving to living, to existing, and then to ecstasy, which is only the perfected form of existing, as we just explained. But this conclusion is that of theomorphism, 100%. Every time something from the Leelas or the scriptures will sound like too literal or too good to be true, let us remember one thing. We are the hints, not the referents. So let us read these Leelas from up to down, never from down to up. And I think we will gradually see ourselves imitating the Leela unconsciously and not the Leela imitating our so-called reality down here. As a final word, I would like to say this. Someone is in love with us, in love beyond anything we can imagine. Like we're living a treasure hunt where our lover has left clues everywhere to let us know how much he desires to interact with us. So these clues are in my neighbor's eyes, the sound of the wind, the light of the sun, even like the suffering of orphans, literally everywhere. And again, I don't mean this as a poetic metaphor. I think this is truly what our cosmos is in essence, in substance, and in purpose.
Vanshakalpatarubhyascha kripasindhobhyayivaccha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavabhyo namo namah. Hare Krishna, thank you for taking time and listening to what I had to say. And I invite anyone who has questions to ask the questions in 1 minute. I have to deal with a technical detail. I'll be back in like 20 seconds. My internet is lagging very much.
Hare Krishna, it should be better now. Sorry for this. If anyone has questions, please ask them. Otherwise, I will close the discussion here. All right. I feel like we're done then. Again, thank you so much. And I'm sure a lot of you have inputs to add to this discussion. And I would love to hear them later on, even if you want to send me private messages or something like this. Hare Krishna.